I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens...
Moving the needle. In response to chaos at the Centers for Disease Control, three states are banding together to create their own vaccine guidelines. One California health official tells us it's necessary because the federal agency is more focused on politics than science.
And Live and Let Dive. The 85-year-old founder of Old Ladies Against Underwater Garbage, who dive into ponds in Cape Cod to clear them of junk that people threw in there, says the project makes them all feel truly alive.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Thursday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're listening to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE KBXE, People Power Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from L&M Fleet Supply, carrying a variety of products for your next outdoor adventure, with 13 locations across the Northland. More at lmsupply.com. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. And Grand Rapids Riverfest is this Saturday. This year's lineup, Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Tickets and info at grandrapidsriverfest.com. And if you're interested in volunteering at the event, head to grandrapidsriverfest.com under Get Involved. Now I'm going to play a tune from the headliner, Courtney Barnett. This song is called Charity.
Thank you.
that's Courtney Barnett with the song Charity. She'll be performing at Grand Rapids Riverfest this Saturday. Get your tickets at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Thrown off balance, RCMP raid the Saskatchewan compound of the self-proclaimed Queen of Canada and arrest 16 people, including the Queen herself. An investigative journalist tells us about the impact that cult has had on its neighbors.
Herd immunity. Facing chaos at the CDC, a group of U.S. states forms its own coalition to make vaccine recommendations, saying the federal agency has become a, quote, political tool.
Man of the cloth, the late Giorgio Armani revolutionized fashion by emphasizing simplicity and elegance. A longtime fashion journalist pays tribute to the influential Italian designer and his unique sense of classic style.
To dive for. Members of the Old Ladies Against Underwater Garbage Club happily brave the depths of ponds to remove trash. The 85-year-old founder tells us it may be gross, but it is an exhilarating adventure.
Desperately hoping to ruffle some feathers, a wildlife vet in New Zealand wants to vaccinate the critically endangered, flightless, waddling parrot called the kakapo against bird flu. But despite their earthbound girth, the problem is catching them.
And retraining day. In a late night interview, an Academy Award winning actor casually tells the world that his name is not actually pronounced Denzel at all. As it happens, the Thursday edition, radio that knows your stress falls when you know where the stress falls. She calls herself the Queen of Canada, but yesterday, cult leader Romana Didolo was given the not-so-royal treatment by the Saskatchewan RCMP. Dozens of officers descended on Ms. Didolo's compound in Richmond, Saskatchewan, a former school where she and her followers have been living for the last 2 years. They arrested 16 people and seized a number of imitation handguns and electronic devices. Today, all 16 were released and two were rearrested. As of airtime, no charges have been laid. Romana Didolo is known as a far-right QAnon conspiracy theorist who tells her followers, among other things, that they do not need to pay taxes. Mac Lamoureux is an investigative journalist who's writing a book about Ms. Didolo's cult. We reached him in Victoria.
Mac, this was a pretty big operation that unfolded before dawn yesterday. Can you just tell our listeners what happened, the kind of police presence that showed up at this compound?
Yeah, I actually was woken up to messages from locals texting me about it. And they told me there was just a massive police presence in town. I believe there was over 30 vehicles used in this. There were multiple teams involved in this. The Romana Didolo, the QAnon queen, actually live streamed her own arrest. And you can see in this stream, even though it's quite blurry and grainy, that the officers that were making their way through the school arresting people were in camouflage military garb with long rifles. So they obviously took this operation rather seriously.
The RCMP has said that this started with a firearms complaint, which, of course, is always serious. But knowing what you know and having followed this for so long, do you think the police were or are looking for much more in searching that compound?
Well, obviously, when you get any sort of report of a firearm, you need to take it quite seriously. What I can say is that the cult doesn't really have a history of, say, stockpiling weapons or anything of that. A lot of the damage that this cult does is very much on a financial and interpersonal level to their followers. That said, they have had issues in the past of kind of violent actions. In one particular case, one of their followers and Romana actually led an ill-fated arrest of an entire police precinct in Peterborough. That went likely exactly as you think it would go, with them being arrested, not the cops. There were a lot of unknowns in this operation. Obviously, the group is extremely secretive. We don't know what's going on in the school. And so I understand the precautions they took.
You mentioned Peterborough. How did they end up in this village in Saskatchewan, which you've been to?
Yeah, it's actually quite an interesting story. They started online on Telegram, this kind of Russian app that's known for its lax moderation. And she started very much kind of picking up steam during the COVID pandemic when everybody was locked inside. They were isolated. A lot of people kind of fell into conspiratorial narrative. It was a bad time for a lot of people, and a lot of people went down some pretty extreme rabbit holes, including some that led them to Romana Ditalo. And then eventually kind of all this online activity morphed itself into her migrating offline. So she was able to then take this cohort and have them essentially buy her an RV. And then she started a convoy across Canada. She started in Victoria, BC. And essentially, she went to go join the Ottawa convoy. That didn't go too well for her. And then she started touring the country. And she did that for a couple of years. And eventually, while she was looking for kind of a place to bunker down over the winter, because as you can imagine, it's not very fun to live in an RV in February in Canada, she heard from a man named Ricky Manns, one of her followers in this small town called Richmond, Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. And he, back in the 2010s, had actually purchased the local school, planning to make it into a legal cannabis grow off after it was decommissioned. And he gifted her the school. And now all of a sudden she has infrastructure.
I was going to ask about where does the money come from? How do you finance this kind of compound? You're saying it's her followers.
Yeah, 100%. Romana doesn't have very much money. At least she didn't at the very start of her journey into, you know, being, for lack of a better term, a cult leader. I've spoken to some of her followers that used to travel with her, including one who she essentially used as a bank account. And people were sending money directly into this woman's bank account, primarily through e-transfers. And they were getting hundreds of thousands of dollars at their peak. And so she's able to get her followers, which are, I hate to say it, primarily kind of older people, not that media illiterate. You kind of know what I'm talking about here. Sending her monthly, weekly donations. She's also made these decrees that they believe that they don't need to pay utility bills. They don't need to pay their mortgages anymore. And in turn, they take that money and send to her. And we've seen reports of people losing their homes. We've seen reports of people having their electricity shut off. And so obviously, if you stop paying your bills and sending your money to a cult leader, that story doesn't necessarily end well for you.
No, it doesn't. What about people in Richmond? You've been speaking to them. Clearly, you've built relationships because they were telling you about police moving in. What have they told you about how their village has transformed with the arrival of this cult?
It's been really interesting. I've been to Richmond a few times, and I've actually grown to quite like the town. And it's one thing I want to get across is this is a tiny, tiny community. When you drive into the town, the first thing you see is the school where they live. And it's been painted this really sharp, bright color of purple, which is Romana's color. It says, I believe, the Kingdom of Canada Command Center. And this is a building where a lot of, you know, the people who live there actually went. And so they've been watching it be corrupted by this kind of invading force. And so there's been a lot of tension between the cult and the locals.
There, as our listeners heard, RCMP had 24 hours to lay formal charges. Mm-hmm. They ended up releasing all 16 folks. Two were rearrested. No formal charges laid at this point. But ultimately, do you think this kind of attention could actually give the cult more power?
I don't know if it could give the cult more power. The one thing about Romana, she's not necessarily growing at an exponential rate that she once was. It's more an act of sustainability at this moment. One of the things that I'm probably most interested in after this operation is the fact that they seized a large amount of electronics, their laptops, their cell phones. And one of the things that I've seen from both speaking to former members following this cult rather closely is that the way that they're able to generate income, the way that they're able to work with people, really at times rides the line of illegality. So there very well may be additional charges that come down the line. Only time will tell.
Good to talk with you, Mac. Thanks for this.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Mac Lamoureux is a journalist and manager at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. He's currently writing a book about Romana Didelot's cult. We reached him in Victoria. This morning, Hollow Water First Nation woke up to a tragedy. An 18-year-old woman was killed and seven people were taken to hospital after a mass stabbing in the early hours of the morning in the community about 200 kilometers northeast of Winnipeg. Police say the suspect was a 26-year-old man from Hollow Water who collided with a police cruiser while fleeing the scene and died. The officer received critical but not life-threatening injuries. Manitoba Premier Wab Kanew talked about the situation earlier today.
Oh, it feels tragic in Manitoba today. This is a time of year where we're sending our kids back to school. Many of us as parents did that this week. And instead, we have a community that is preparing to bury its young. It's a time of year in this province where we harvest the bounty of the land. And yet we have some of our fellow Manitobans in hospital consoling their loved ones who were the victims of something terrible here. One of whom is a police officer who we're still finding out the details of what happened about, but we can say that she is a hero. We don't know the specifics yet. We will in the coming days, I'm sure. But she stopped a man on a rampage. So on behalf of the province of Manitoba, I thank her. And I send my sincere condolences to the family members of the victim and also to the survivors. I send you our best encouragement for your healing. I also want to acknowledge that this is personal for one of the members of our team in your provincial government. Our Minister of Natural Resources and Indigenous Futures, Ian Bushy, is a band member of Chief Barker's community, is a proud citizen of Hollow Water First Nation, and is, as we speak at home, reeling in the way that his fellow community members are. And I say this to everyone in Manitoba. Our primary responsibility is always to ensure your safety as Manitobans. And when something like this happens, the immediate response needs to be law enforcement. But we also, as Manitobans, know that for the long-term safety of our communities, we have to help with healing for those who are really, really struggling. And here I'm not talking about the suspect. We bring the hammer down on those responsible. I'm talking about people who are suffering in community, who are battling addictions, who are battling unresolved trauma, who are the victims of terrible abuse when they're young. We will be there with compassion and support for them.
Manitoba Premier Wab Kanew speaking at a press conference in Winnipeg earlier today about a mass stabbing in the Hollow Water First Nation. He was the king of Italian fashion, a designer whose work was admired and celebrated in the hottest of haute couture circles, but also spoken about in hushed tones by people in the non-fashion world who dreamed of wearing an Armani. The legendary Italian designer Giorgio Armani died today at the age of 91. He was known, among other things, for revolutionizing the suit for men and women and for a luxuriously elegant aesthetic that's had an incalculable influence in the world of fashion. Susie Menkes is a longtime fashion journalist and critic. She knew Giorgio Armani. We reached her in London.
Susie, you just posted a video of you and Mr. Armani. It looks like it might be backstage somewhere. He clearly has affection for you. You're speaking for quite some time. You're speaking French, I should point out, so clearly you both speak several languages. But when was that video recorded?
Well, I've seen him on so many occasions. Yes. And while you've picked that one, the one that really interested me was when we won his boat together.
Oh.
And I'm not really a boat person. And to my amazement, he told me he isn't really, well, he wasn't actually, this is the same attitude, that he wasn't so mad about it. And I was so surprised because there were always these photographs of him on a boat. But there you are. What do you know about people's secrets?
What was he doing on a boat? Is it just what well-known fashion designers do then?
He had the most beautiful thing that I've ever seen. Mm. And I know nothing about boats, but it certainly impressed me. But I think that what is impressive about Giorgio Armani is that he created so much, and yet not in a noisy way, drawing attention to himself or to the people who wore his clothes. It was exactly the opposite. He bought things that were suitable for the changing world. And it started with men, of course. And I think the fact that he could bring out clothes for men that looked stylish and well cut, but at the same time were easy to wear and comfortable. He was blessed by most of the men in the world who rushed out and bought again and again the clothes of Giorgio Armani.
Well, the phrase Armani suit, whether you were lucky enough to see one, let alone buy one or wear one, I mean, it's synonymous with, well, certainly an expensive suit, but a beautifully cut, draped, perfect
But
suit.
It's interesting you say that about words, because the Armani Privé, which is a sort of couture collection, very interesting that he chose this word, private, because they weren't so private, these clothes. So many were worn by famous people and in Hollywood and other places when the grand are brought together. But the fact that he put so much work into that Armani Privé was such a surprise to me. I've always thought of him not as a dull person, not at all, but still quite a serious person. And then suddenly he seemed to be much more frivolous. Why not? I don't think that's quite the word.
Frivolous, I hear what you're saying, but his gowns on so many, you know, famous actresses in particular. But you mentioned his quiet elegance. Others have described it that way as well. What did he tell you about wanting to do that Privé collection and have those kinds of moments?
I think that he wanted to do everything in fashion, and that he had no doubt met lots of women who said, I wish you would make clothes for me, and then he did. And I think that's part of it. And the other part is that he also, I think, loved his country. You know, Italy is extraordinary for what it has produced, and still continues to produce, in clothing that is so beautifully, precisely cut, and also decorated in such an extraordinary way. After all, he's not the only person. People come from across the world to Italy to have their clothes made. Mm-hmm. But I think that's very much part of it, that he was interested in making things that are beautiful.
You've seen catwalks change. You've seen runways and red carpets change as well. I wonder what you think Mr. Armani would think of the time, or what he thought about the time we're in, where it's about a lot of big moments, method dressing. Did he ever tell you what he thought of all of that? Or he just did his own thing and that told you what you needed to know?
In general, Giorgio Armani was always a bit grumpy when somebody else had sort of got into the limelight, particularly with ridiculous clothes. He didn't like that. He felt that clothes should be something that was calm and somehow fitted in every sense of the word with the person who wore it. And I think perhaps more for women than for men, he was really firm in that they should not be clothes that were ridiculous in any way or unsuitable or just unusable or any of those things.
He was instrumental, obviously, in crafting what the modern woman wanted to wear, whether it was on a runway or, you know, in the 80s, in the workplace, the power suits. But interestingly, people may not know, you know, it's a multi-billion dollar company that goes beyond clothing, fragrance, cosmetics, all of that. But 9,000 employees, half of the executives were women, as I understand it. Do you know if that was intentional on his part or his team's part?
I don't think Giorgio Armani ever did anything that hadn't got a reason behind it. Mm. I don't think that he just casually found that he'd employed more women than men, and how unexpected. He was just not that sort of person. He would have had a vision of a world, and that is his vision. When he made clothes for men and for women. And of course, in his mind, he must have thought about them being together, living together, being the man and the woman of his time. And, you know, that's a good attitude. Yes, I'm sure that very young women of today probably would look at it and say that's for older women. But so what? You know, he knew who he wanted to dress and he dressed them.
Is there a particular piece in your closet that you're very grateful to have that you were looking at today?
You won't believe this. It was a joke, really, between Mr. Armani and myself. I never had any of his clothes. I, you know, was of the school that I didn't accept clothes from designers,
yes,
so I had to buy them.
Yeah.
And they just weren't my kind of look. They were perfect for just about the whole world except me, so I don't know.
You have a very distinct style, yes. You have.
I think he decided that it was quite funny that I should be so ridiculous as not to wear his clothes. And it probably is. I probably should have done. But never too late. He may have gone, but he's left so much behind. And maybe you'll see me in one of his suits one day.
Maybe we will, Susie, one day. Thank you very much for your time.
So, well, it's an honor to be asked.
Susie Menkes is a longtime fashion journalist and critic. We reached her in London, England. Giorgio Armani died today at the age of 91. They are the world's fattest parrots, and they cannot fly. But that doesn't mean that New Zealand's beloved kakapo are necessarily easy to catch, as Kate McInnes knows all too well. Ms. McInnes is a wildlife veterinarian and a senior science advisor with New Zealand's Department of Conservation. She's devoted a good chunk of her career to protecting these critically endangered birds. And these days, that includes protecting them from the threat of bird flu. The latest variant of that deadly virus has yet to reach the island, but if it does, it could have devastating consequences for the kakapo. So Ms. McInnes and her colleagues are rushing to test the parrot's response to a vaccine designed for poultry when they can catch them. We reached Kate McInnes in Wellington.
Kate, as catching birds go, what kind of level of difficulty are we talking about with this bird?
Oh, with the kakapo, it can be anything from super, super easy to absolutely impossible.
What makes it almost impossible?
So it's more if they decide they're going to roost somewhere mm-hmm. which is inaccessible to humans. Right. So I have in the past crawled into a cave, and I'm a little bit claustrophobic, so it wasn't my happy time.
Oh.
And they were under these rocks, or it was one bird, it was under some rocks, and yeah, it was way, way, way at the back. Other times we've gone to catch a bird and it's been 8 metres up a tree and just, you know, impossible to get there safely. And so in that case, we just come back the next day and the next day and the next day.
try and try again. I've seen some video and photographs now, but many of our listeners may never have seen a kakapo. Can you describe them for us?
The kakapo is just a beautiful, gentle bird. So they're a big, fat parrot. They're about 3.5 kilograms, so that's absolutely huge for a parrot. Mm. And they're round. They don't fly, so they walk along the ground. They kind of waddle along the ground. Being a parrot, they have very short legs. And they're this iridescent green moss colour with sort of patterny stripes in it. So they're incredibly camouflaged when they're in the forest. If they're, you know, sitting under a fern, you just can't see them. But fortunately for us, you can smell them. And they have this really sweet, musty smell. And when you've worked with them for a while, it's just your nose gets absolutely triggered whenever you smell that smell. It's absolutely beautiful. And they have the most soulful eyes when you're catching them or watching them. They turn their head and look at you, and your heart just melts.
Oh, it's easy to become enamored of them, it sounds like. Though I'm surprised that no perfume company has not isolated this intoxicating scent you describe. There's another interesting facet to these birds, it makes it difficult, is that there are very few left. They don't breed that often.
That's right. So there's only just over 250 existing in the whole of the world, all found in New Zealand. And one of the problems is that they only breed when a particular type of tree fruits. and that tree only fruits every 2 to 5 years. Oh, so we can go a long time between baby birds.
So that I can tell is part of the reason why you were so worried if bird flu were to arrive in New Zealand, and you're looking at other birds as well, other threatened species. If it were to land there, bird flu, what is your worst case scenario? What do you and your colleagues play out in your mind?
I guess our biggest fear is we don't know sort of when it will arrive, where it will arrive, and just what it will do to our native New Zealand species. And because they've evolved in isolation from the rest of the world for a long, long time, we just can't really predict what will happen in New Zealand. So we just have to be prepared for pretty much every eventuality. And so as we've been doing, we've been working on a vaccine trial to see if we can also vaccinate some of the key birds to have a protected group in the most vulnerable species.
How has that vaccine been working on the kakapo? Because this vaccine is not designed for this kind of bird.
That's absolutely right. So this is a commercial chicken vaccine. And what we found is it's produced really good antibodies in all the birds we've used it in. Very small trial, just 10 per species and 5 different species, so only 50 birds in total. But they did really well with the vaccine. They had no bad effects from it, and they made these antibodies, which we're hoping will be the protection they need if bird flu gets to New Zealand.
Before we let you go, I think it's very important that we ask you about one of the other efforts to protect the kakapo. The kakapo sex helmet. Do tell.
I get asked about this quite a lot.
I wonder why.
It's kind of my biggest failure, but it was also, you had to try it. So we wanted to make sure that we were capturing all the genetics from all the kakapo. So we wanted to get those ones who hadn't bred yet. And the way to do that would be to collect sperm and do artificial insemination. And so we tried a few ways of collecting sperm, and this is just another one, and it was based on a small falcon from overseas where it had been done using a hat and an imprinted male. And we happened to have an imprinted male kakapo that had been sick in a nest and had to be hand-raised, and then it decided it preferred people. So being in New Zealand, I got a rugby helmet, and then I covered it in silicon gel to make little wells, and we let the kakapo jump on and bonk my head. But unfortunately, even with 25 minutes of this bird bonking away on my head, he didn't get over that finish line. So eventually we abandoned the helmet.
Okay.
And then we rediscovered a technique, which was you can do a massage. If you give them an appropriate massage, they'll actually produce sperm for you.
I'm afraid to ask, but I'm going to. What are you talking? How are you massaging these birds?
Actually, you just stroke down their legs.
Okay.
It must be the nerves in the legs in that region, make them go, oh, yeah, it's kind of bizarre, but, much nicer for the birds, I think.
These birds are lucky to have you and your team. You will stop at nothing to make sure they're okay.
They certainly have a devoted group of, team members and followers helping them as much as we possibly can. Yeah.
Kate, I appreciate this. Thank you.
It's my pleasure.
Bye.
Kate McInnes is a wildlife veterinarian and a senior science advisor with New Zealand's Department of Conservation. She's in Wellington.
We are going to take a quick break now. When we return, while the U.S. Health Secretary is defending his controversial policies at Senate hearings, several U.S. states are decrying RFK Jr.'s changes and taking vaccine guidelines into their own hands.
And one of Hollywood's most celebrated actors offers insight into how everyone, including his mother and himself, wound up mispronouncing his first name. Stay tuned, I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
It is 6:35, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on member-supported KAXE KBXE. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with Old Man River. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. We receive support from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. And we receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. And looking at weather today, showers likely, cloudy with temps in the low 40s, northwest winds gusting up to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs in the mid to upper 50s, breezy northwest winds. Evening temps in the low 40s.
The vaccine debate in the United States wasn't getting less intense, but it just got a shot in the arm anyway. Today, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was in the hot seat facing extremely pointed questions from senators over the direction that he's taking health policy. And yesterday, the Surgeon General of Florida, Joseph Latipo, made a startling announcement.
The Florida Department of Health, in partnership with the governor, is going to be working to end all vaccine mandates in Florida law. All of them. All of them. All of them. Every last one of them. Every last one of them. All of them. Every last one of them. Every last one of them is wrong and drips with disdain and slavery.
And while Florida seeks to scrap vaccine mandates, a coalition of states on the other side of the country announced they will work together to maintain theirs and to ensure research continues despite cuts at the federal level. California, Oregon, and Washington State will make up the West Coast Health Alliance, the first such compact to arise to push back against the new administration's policies. Dr. Karen Smith is the interim health officer for Sonoma, California, and the former health officer for the state. We reached her in Napa, California.
Dr. Smith, you heard, as we did, Florida's Surgeon General there said that yesterday and said vaccine mandates, quote, drip with disdain and slavery. What do you make of that kind of talk from someone who holds the position he holds?
Well, it's certainly unusual for a Surgeon General or other state-level health official to speak in such a politically slanted way is rare. Most of us try very hard to keep our public speech to the strict facts of the science. And I'm not familiar with how you come up with that kind of color to put around something like vaccination.
The West Coast Health Alliance, on the most basic level, what do you want our listeners to know how it will work? What is its top priority from where you sit?
I was not involved in the creation of it. I'm very happy that it's happened. But based on what Governor Newsom has put out here in California and listening to our current state health official, Dr. Erica Pan, the goal at this point is to ensure that the three states that have come together, they're going to put their scientific minds together and really look hard at the recommendations that are currently coming out for vaccines, not just from the CDC, but also from the professional associations. OBGYN's recommendations for vaccines for pregnant women and pediatricians, obviously, for kids. And those recommendations within the alliance, they intend to look at the recommendations, but also look at the science behind the recommendations and make the best decisions, and will stand together with recommendations for the three states.
The creation of this alliance came up today at RFK Jr.'s hearing before the Senate Financial Committee. We want to play a clip now. Senator Maria Cantwell from Washington State.
You canceled $500 million of research because the mRNA technology is about continuing the research to be ready for the next flu influenza, the next pandemic, and you have to do the research.
I'm happy to have a detailed discussion with you about it. You're so wrong on your facts.
You're interrupting me. And, sir, you're a charlatan. That's what you are. So, yes, the governors of the West, Washington, Oregon, and California, will take up the efficacy of science. Yes, the University of Washington will deliver the science that America will depend on, because you don't want to depend on it.
There's a couple things I want to ask you, Dr. Smith. Just the tone of these meetings. I don't know if you've heard other clips as well. People have been pointing out how extraordinary it is, the tone that the secretary is taking with senators. That was unusual. How did that sit with you?
The thing that I hear in Secretary Kennedy's tone, and this has been true in other times that I've listened to him respond in public settings, in this particular case, I think one of the first things is actually defensiveness. It comes across as aggression, but it's also, I think he is in a sort of defensive posture. The person who's asking the questions is standing solidly on years and years of science, and Secretary Kennedy is essentially speaking from his personal belief system. And so it's very difficult. I'm sure he feels attacked, and that's what his response sounds like to me.
The other question that clip raises is $500 million from research funding cut, as we heard from Senator Cantwell. The West Coast Health Alliance, how can it even begin to replace that kind of support for research?
Oh, it can't. It absolutely can't. I think if the federal government is not going to fund this kind of research, we're going to be in a position where we need to find multiple different kinds of sources. State governments have some funding, but so does pharma. And quite frankly, the outcome of it for a pharmaceutical company also stands to make them a substantial amount of money. And so I think we can combine some of the pure research interests, but also there is some capitalism at play in this as well, if we're going to create a system where we can even begin to replace that kind of funding.
Does it keep you up at night to think where we might be in a year or 2 years? Where do you think people across the United States will be?
It does keep me up at night. I'm something of an optimist in that, at least in the United States, a very large majority of the adults in the United States believe in vaccination. And our challenge now is to make sure that they get clear information so that they know how to navigate the chaos, the noise that's out there. I don't think the majority of people are going to turn away from vaccines in a state of confusion. What we're struggling to do, and we are committed to doing, is making that choice as clear as we possibly can for folks.
Dr. Smith, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Karen Smith is the interim health officer for Sonoma, California, and the former health officer for the whole state. We reached her in Napa, California. In the summer of 2019, a saga gripped the NBA and most of all fans of the Toronto Raptors. After leading the team to its first ever championship, star player Kawhi Leonard had the choice to go and play for a new team or to re-sign with the Raptors and try to repeat their success. Well, despite desperate pleas from Raptors fans and a lucrative contract offer, he left. He signed with the Los Angeles Clippers, the team owned by former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer. Now, a report by the podcast Pablo Torre Finds Out may have revealed more about why Mr. Leonard made that choice. On yesterday's episode, the show claimed that an endorsement deal between Mr. Leonard and a California-based sustainability service company allegedly allowed the Clippers to pay him more money than the NBA's salary cap rules permit, like a lot more. Here's host Pablo Torre talking about what they uncovered.
So there was a company called Aspiration, and Aspiration was a climate change company, a quote-unquote green bank. The basic premise of it is we plant some trees to zero out your carbon footprint. And their big endorsers were Leonardo DiCaprio and Robert Downey Jr. and Drake. Drake is in this story, for those who were wondering, where is Drake in this? Well, he's up there near the top.
I wasn't, but yes.
And, well, Drake's private jet, you know, needed to be zeroed out. You needed to have some trees planted to balance it out. But the biggest endorsement deal that Aspiration signed, it went to Kawhi Leonard, who got $28 million for what can only be described, per seven sources and over 3,000 pages of documents from inside the company, which we acquired, as a no-show job. And the whole Clippers part of it is that Steve Ballmer invested $50 million of his own money via his own LLC, documentation on that as well. And also, for those who may be vaguely familiar familiar with the name Aspiration, this was a company that signed a 23-year, $300 million-plus sponsorship deal with the Clippers as the Intuit Dome was opening. They were going to get the jersey patch. They had the thing on the back of the courtside seats. They were everywhere. And this was, according to these seven sources, all a deal to circumvent the salary cap. And you guys know this, right? Like, salary cap circumvention in the NBA has long been rumored. And there have only been a couple of instances in which the punishment is so significant that we remember it. And we can talk about that if you want. This one just feels different.
Pablo Torre speaking to Dave Dufour on the Athletic's NBA Daily podcast. The NBA has said it will launch its own investigation into the matter. If you happen to be near a pond in Cape Cod and someone suddenly bursts to the surface of the water gasping and clutching a rusted empty can of Sprite, don't worry. It's just a proud member of the group OLAUG, Old Ladies Against Underwater Garbage. The group has 30 members who range in age from 65 to 85, and in their pond dives over the years, they found items ranging from golf balls and beer cans to a toilet and the back end of a car. 85-year-old Susan Bauer is an author and psychologist who started Old Ladies Against Underwater Garbage in 2018. We reached her in North Falmouth, Massachusetts.
Susan, when was your last group dive?
Yesterday was my last scouting. We scouted three different ponds, but an actual dive was probably 3 days ago. In the month of August, it got jammed up by mistake, but I did 12. And that is so too many.
That is a lot, plus the scouting. So that gives us a bit of an inside look into the preparation that goes into this as well. What did you and the team pull out of the water?
My great find was I dove down and saw what looked like a coil of wire. And it was about 150 feet long, but it was coiled up like a slinky, and like a huge, enormous slinky. And I just picked it up in the middle and brought it up, and we draped it over a kayak and then began hauling it in to get it into the kayak. In the same dive, we found the back of the transom of a boat. We found the tiller of a boat, and we found a 10-pound anchor. Try pulling that up out of the mud. That took a couple of people.
I was going to say, but you did it. You didn't just try. You succeeded.
Oh, no, we do. Well, the heaviest thing we've probably taken out is the back end of a Corvette. But
of course,
you did. The 80-pound toilet. Yeah. Well, there's nothing three women can't do.
I think you're right about that. And I understand that each of your divers has an area of expertise. What is yours?
Each of us has an eccentricity, a specialty. If you want somebody to get something out of a deep place, you ask Marcy. If you want somebody to get teeny tiny stuff, you ask Mary. If it's disgusting, call me. it's like, ew, what is that? That's my specialty.
I bet a lot of people hear about your group and they're going to hear this conversation and they're going to say, I want to do this. But
yes.
You don't just show up. There's a process and tryouts. What do those tryouts entail?
What we worry about the most is safety. Safety, safety, safety. You want to go in with 12 swimmers. You want to come out with 12 swimmers. You really, really do. And you don't want to scare anybody to the point where they really don't feel that it's safe. There's broken glass. There are 50-pound snapping turtles. There's fishing line that you don't want to get caught up in. And you're driving repeatedly to 10 feet, 12 feet. You come up with a couple of beer cans, you give them to the kayaker, and you'll flash her a number of fingers because you can't really talk because you've got your snorkel in your mouth. And we don't wear fins, so this is effortful, the whole thing. You flash her a number of fingers and say, that's how many beer cans are down there. Don't leave, you know, right. Don't go to your other swimmer. And then you go down, and if you're really good, you can stuff them in the front of your bathing suit and come up with all four of them. But mostly, I've gotten three at the most, but other people are better than I am. So what they have to do is to swim a half a mile in under 30 minutes, which is, you don't do that with the side stroke or the breast stroke. Usually you are doing a freestyle. Mm-hmm. And then you have to finish that mile. You don't have to finish it at that same pace. But in other words, you have to be very comfortable swimming for an hour and a half. That's how long our cleanups take. And we're often in cold water. We start in May. We scout through October. We're tough. We're a bunch of toughies.
So we want to make sure everybody does. So is there a wait list?
45 people right now are on the wait list. And there are at least five states who would like a chapter and two countries. We'll add Canada.
Well, I
betcha.
It's only natural. How do you feel about how this has exploded?
It's nuts. It is the last thing in the world that I expected. Old Ladies Against Underwater Garbage grew out of a time when I spent a huge amount of time alone. One, I've done the writing life, which is a great deal of time alone. My sport of choice was running. I ran for 45 years through the woods alone. And for the last 20 years, I have swum alone in the evenings looking for turtles. And it grew from that. So to go from that, which seemed like a sort of normal way to wind down in your 70s and 80s, and you appreciated nature more, and you just walked your dog, and you became this isolated little speck, and to be sucked into this terrific group of women. I mean, one of our sources of great joy, in fact, for some women, they would say the great source of joy, is that there is such camaraderie. Yeah. We rely on each other. And anytime, it's like a band of brothers. It's sort of like the military, because we are warriors. If it's raining, we go in. If it's cold and there are white caps, we go in. We are so focused in that dark, beautiful pond with maybe water lilies and always fish and occasionally turtles, to look for that straight line that shouldn't be there, that pink, that red, that color, that shape that shouldn't be there. You lose all consciousness of yourself. You're not political. You're not even mortal. You're a perfect person in a perfect world.
If I could jump in the water right now, if I was next to a body of water, I would. And our listeners heard that you're 85, and I just underline it because I think the curiosity, the activity, the passion that you're talking about is key.
Yeah, I think you have to have all three. And then I'd add one more, and that is that openness to enchantment, that openness to wonder. So if you want to say that aging, with its inevitable losses, you're going to lose strength, you're going to lose memory, eyesight, hearing, your friends, you're going to lose. If that, and death, of course, ultimately, if that's the problem, what's the answer? The answer is wonder, is that wonder born of curiosity and passion and creativity. And it doesn't stop you from dying. It doesn't stop you from losing, but it gives you a reliable vacation. And who doesn't want moments of just total relief and wonder? And we've found a way to get them.
You sure have, Susan. What a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for this.
Oh, you're welcome, Neil.
Susan Bauer is the founder of Old Ladies Against Underwater Garbage. We reached her in North Falmouth, Massachusetts. Some actors are so famous, so brilliant, so legendary that I only have to say their first names and you'll know exactly who I'm talking about. Meryl, Marlon, Keanu, Oprah. I mean, Oprah, or wait, how do you, like, what's the right pronunciation? I don't, oh, I'm sorry. I'm being told it is Oprah. Oh, also that it's Keanu, Marlon, and Meryl, right? Oh, also that I spilled some yogurt on my shirt? I did? Oh, yeah. Well, look, I was confused and upset. I heard something this morning that has completely upended my understanding of how to pronounce anything. And at the risk of prompting you to turn off your radio and all the lights, whereupon you will sit in silence listening to the inexorable tick-tock of your grandfather clock and questioning every single thing you believe, here is the shocking thing I heard.
My name's not pronounced Denzel.
Now, even in a two-second clip, you know exactly who that is. It's that Washington guy on Jimmy Kimmel Live last night. You know, one of the best actors of all time, who we all thought we were on a first-name basis with. But I know we all need a minute to figure out how to live from now on. So let's just sit quietly and we'll listen to a bit more of Jimmy Kimmel talking to Mr. Washington.
Guys, and they were usually black.
Did you know that there are currently four players named Denzel in the NFL?
I know.
And before your...
There's a lot of Denzels now.
There weren't that many before your first Oscar. There were zero in 1987.
And this is how you know they named themselves after me. Because, wait a minute, because my name's not pronounced Denzel. My name's pronounced Denzel.
Oh.
I'm Denzel Jr. My father's Denzel Hayes Washington Sr. I'm Denzel Hayes Washington, Jr. My mother would say, Denzel, and we both show up. So she said, from now on, you're Denzel.
Well,
that's how we got pronounced Denzel.
Oh, that's smart.
She said, you're Denzel. You're Denzel, and you're Denzel.
Our long national nightmare is over. It is Denzel, after all. Now we can all feel confident saying his name again when we discuss him along with fellow stars like Nicole Kidman, Joaquin Phoenix, and Ryan Gosling. Here's Hannah Georges with Not the Name You Say.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.